Well, this talk is going to be a little, it's going to lack focus a little bit, mostly because I have collaborators who are going to talk later about some of the best self-contained things we've been doing recently. So I was left with the most exciting but somewhat hardest to discuss topic. I should also warn you that I'm really taking a point of view of a conformal field theorist, meaning I'm thinking of field theories and lattice models, and not so much SLE curves. And there may be some confusion sometimes because of the vocabulary. So anyway, most geometrical exponents we are interested in and have calculated so far, percolation would be one of the examples, self-avoiding walls would be another, are related ultimately with what I call compact conformal field theories. That is, conformal field theories whose target space, the space where the field variable is defined, is compact. Typically, we're dealing with free bosons, which have some finite radius and some charge at infinity, or a Coulomb gas. But again, the target space is a compact space. Intuitively, I always thought, and it's quite obvious, that this has something to do with the self-avoidance of the curves that ultimately we're interested in, curves that may sometimes touch themselves at points, but a thing that occurs rather seldom. Again, the example, the typical example is the self-avoiding walk, which is self-avoiding. This is in contrast with the standard Gaussian model, which has a field theory, is simply a theory with a field phi that takes values over the whole real line. It's a non-compact target space. And we know that this field theory, at the naivest level, if we're not interested in boundaries, but just plainly in the correlators of the field theory itself, is related with geometrical objects which are not self-avoiding, and it's insulting probably to remind you that the two-point function of the free Gaussian field theory, which whose action I wrote here, is simply the sum over all the Brownian paths, non-self-avoiding curves, going from point one to point two. Okay? So we have these two worlds, and I personally consider that they are not connected enough, and the goal I would have would be to connect these two worlds along some lines which I'm going to explain. Intuitively, the non-compactedness of the target space in the case of the free boson, of course, has something to do with the fact that the path, the curves, can go an infinite number of times through the sides or the bounds of the system, and therefore, whatever variable you want to describe the system needs to encode an infinite number of numbers, the number of times the curve can go through the system. But I'm going to try to Yeah, we were discussing that the easiest to prepare and the hardest to give are talks on the blackboard, and the hardest to prepare and the easiest to give are talks on the computer. Transparencies are in between, how to prepare and how to All right. Now, one of the many reasons I'm interested in non-compact conformal field theories is that I have always an eye on string theory and many friends doing string theory, and I've been suitably impressed by the progress their techniques have given rise to in the study of pure non-compact field theories. Theories such as, for instance, the SL2R Vesumino model, the Vesumino model where the matrix field G takes values in SL2R instead of SU2, supergroups like SU21, in which I've been interested in myself, the SL2R over U1, the SIGAR conformal field theory, etc. Therefore, it's also very tantalizing to ask oneself, can we use some of these results, some of these conformal field theories which have different features from the compact conformal field theories, in order, for instance, to solve new geometrical problems that one would not have thought of before.
Just terminology question here.
Yeah.
I mean, your distinction over there, really to me, is more self-avoiding walk and three dimensions is essentially transient, while Brownian motion is recurrent. Is that your use of compact?
Well, think simply of introducing a variable per lattice bound, telling you how many times you've gone through it.
But okay.
That variable for self-avoiding walks is compact, it's 0 or 1. That variable for Brownian motion is not compact, it can go from 0 to infinity.
Would you call it compact or Brownian motion in 3 dimensions?
Sorry?
If you're in 3 dimensions in Brownian motion, would you call it compact?
At the lattice level, I would call it a non-compact form, because I can go an infinite number of times. Of course, then the question will arise when I take the continuum limit of that problem. Will it still be a compact or non-compact problem? And then that's why the problem is somewhat has to be defined independently on the lattice and in the continuum limit. And I was careful to specify that I'm interested in non-compact conformal field theory. So I'm interested in a field theory whose degrees of freedom really explore the whole of a non-compact manifold. It would not be the case for three-dimensional ground motion, probably, but it is for two-dimensional ground motion. Right. So an obvious integrable an obvious direction to start from when you're thinking of non-compact conformal field theories is to start from lattice models for which the variables on the lattice live in a non-compact space. And obviously, a natural choice is to take integrable chains based on infinite representations. This is a different mathematical topic, maybe, from the one people are expert in here. But you all know that quantum groups are related with integrable systems, and they are compact as well as non-compact. All right. Another direction is based on the question that was just asked. It's the fact that it's not so straightforward to connect the compactedness of the field theory with the compactedness of the lattice model. One could imagine, for instance, to have models which are non-compact on the lattice, but nevertheless are described by compact field theory. Especially, it's not so easy to make this connection when you're thinking about the issue of non-unitarity. And I'm going to argue very soon that lattice models which have finite degrees of freedom but are non-unitary enough, meaning they involve enough signs, will turn out to be described by non-compact conformal field theories. And a particularly friendly way of introducing signs is to have supergroup symmetry. I think I'll get back to. So at the end, I have a little statement which I realized with discussing with Ilya was a bit confusing maybe. But again, one of the things I would like to do would be to put together the problem of DS non-intersection exponents for random walks and the Brownian field itself within a single field theory. That's the kind of result I would like to appreciate, and I haven't seen such results so far, so that's part of my motivation. Alright, so it's going to be a rather not very focused talk again, because I'm going to start with some simple examples. I did not want to launch into discussing technicalities of non-compact field theories. I wanted to stay as close as possible to geometrical problems and shapes, since after all that's the topic of this conference. And therefore it's going to be a rather long story, and I'm not sure how far I go, where I'll start from simple models and then move on towards more complicated questions. Okay? I'm going first to discuss a problem which we worked on with Jesper and then Sokal, Portiello and Caracciolo, that has something to do with the arboreal gas, and that's been one of the first occurrences of non-compact field theories from the point of view of geometrical problems. All right, so that problem is extremely well defined. It's a problem where one is interested in statistical properties of spanning forests. So here is a spanning forest on the square lattice. I'll raise it a bit for a minute so everybody can see comfortably. It's a forest, meaning it's made of trees. A tree is a subgraph with no root. And it's spanning, meaning every vertex of the lattice has to belong to one tree. Okay? It's perfectly compact in the sense that there's at most one tree per edge or vertex. And it's a technicality that I consider a single point as a very small tree. Okay? There are various questions one can ask in this setup. The naivest question one can consider probably is think of the partition function of this arboreal gas, meaning the sum over all the possible coverings of the lattice with spanning forests of, well, the number of such coverings with p components times a certain fugacity raised to the power p. So A in these notations is just a fugacity of a tree. Many of you might remember that there is a well-known problem, which is a problem of the spanning tree, which would be this problem in the limit A goes to 0, where you want a single spanning tree to cover the whole lattice, a well-known problem, and I'll mention it immediately. But you may also remember that the problem I mentioned of spanning tree is the Q goes to 0 limit of the Q state Post model, and it's easy to slightly modify the Q goes to 0 limit of the Q state Post model in order to obtain the problem of spanning forests. So let me go over this very briefly. You remember that the Post model is defined initially as the partition function of a system of variables sigma, taking values from 1 to q, defined on every vertex of the lattice, with an interaction of the form e to the k delta Kronecker of sigma I sigma j. And then there is a sort of little cuisine amounting to expanding the partition function in graphs over, so this is an expansion over all graphs with a certain number of clusters and a certain number of edges, and using Euler's relation, blah, blah. I don't want to spend too much time on this. The point is that you can map this easily in the limit q goes to 0, provided you send the coupling k to 1 proportional to q. You can easily map this partition function to the generating function of the arboreal case. Okay. So that's the first problem I want to discuss. It's a perfectly well-defined problem. And the kind of question I'm going to be interested in will be, in particular, the singularities of the partition function as a function of A. I could also ask questions about the geometrical properties of the trees. It's something I'll do a little bit, but just a little bit. All right. Now, this result, a beautiful result that has a rather long and amusing history, is that the generating function of spanning trees of forests has a completely closed form expression as a Grassmann integral. So I'm going just to mention the result, give some justification, but not a proof. The proof would take too much time. I don't want to spend time on this. But the point is the following. So the partition function, again, is the sum of all coverings of the lattice with spanning forests. And I'm claiming it is equal to the following slightly alien-looking object, maybe, which is a Grassmann integral. So everybody here knows Grassmann variables, which are anti-commuting. So I'm taking every vertex of the lattice. For every vertex, I'm introducing a pair of Grassmann variables. I labels the vertices. The variables are, Grassmann variables are eta 1, eta 2, and they are essentially defined through integration properties of the type integral of d eta 1, d eta 2, eta 1, eta 2 equals 1, pretty much all the rest being 0, and they anti-commute. So the crucial point is that such an integral with a well-chosen action in complete closed form is equal to the generating function for the spanning trees. So the integral is the following. You have to take the exponential of eta 1 m eta 2, which is a shorthand notation for the discrete Laplacian. So remember, I have eta 1 of I and eta 2 of I over every side of the lattice. The discrete Laplacian, of course, is the matrix, which has diagonal elements equal to the number of neighbors of a given side, and other elements, m I j, equals to minus 1 if sides I and j are neighbors, and 0 otherwise. I'm using this general notation because, in fact, the result is true for any graph, but I use it mostly for the square lattice. So I have this discrete Laplacian here, and going a little bit ahead of myself, I could remind you that if it were not for the other term, this integral would be equal to the determinant of the Laplacian, which, when you subtract the zero mode, is well known to be equal to the number of spanning trees. That's Kirchhoff's theorem. In a way, this result, therefore, is a generalization of Kirchhoff's theorem, a beautiful generalization, because it's allowing us to cut the trees into forests at a very cheap price of just a small modification of the action. The modification is the following. You need to have an other term, which, of course, commutes with this one, but I'm writing it separately to make things clearer, that involves the variable A, the fugacity of the trees, and that has two components. One is, I'll speak like a physicist, a sort of mass term, It is a sum of all the sides of the lattice of the product theta 1 of I theta 2 of I. And then the other one is a very interesting term from the point of view of a physicist, because it's a quartic term. That's what makes the theory interacting as opposed to free. The partition function will not be a determinant anymore. It will be a more complicated object. This sum is simply the sum of all pairs of neighbors of the product theta 1 of I, theta 2 of I, theta 1 of J, theta 2 of J. Now the claim is that this integral, which can be calculated in elementary way by expanding the exponentials, finding out which terms are non-zero using the basic rules of Grassmann integration and matching term by term with the trees, indeed this integral is equal to the generating function of the spanning trees. Okay? That's the result we got for a few years back already. Again, as A goes to zero, the leading term on the right hand side is the term with P equals 1, which is the covering of the square lattice with one spanning tree, and it's Kirchhoff's theorem that the number of spanning trees on a graph is the determinant prime of the discrete Laplacian, which is a result you recover from this formulation, because in the limit A goes to zero, you're getting a quadratic Gaussian integral, and that's one of the basic results of Grassmann integration, that such integral is the determinant of the quadratic form. Okay, so that's a generalization, which works by, it looks nice, but really when this thing came up, I thought it was really amazing. And the proof is just to expand, and the idea is that terms from Q1 and Q2 kill off parts of the graph, and then you count the number of trees on the remaining part using Kirchhoff's theorem. Okay. Anyway, the point is not to focus about this lesson, but to use it. Now, it's the beginning of the story, and the continuation of the story is that this object is fascinating for a physicist, because it is a sigma model on the supergroup. Now, this might appear a little surprising at first, and historically it's amusing that Sokal and his collaborators sort of started with this result, calculated graphs perturbatively in the field theory, and sort of observed perturbatively a symmetry, while Jesper and I sort of started from the sigma model and then deduced what it meant from a lattice point of view, and then the two points of view converged. So anyway, this model over there is a sigma model on the supergroup. I'm going to explain what I mean rather quickly. The idea is to introduce an auxiliary variable, which I will call phi, and which will be a bosonic variable in contrast with the fermions, the Grassmann variables I had before, in such a way that phi squared plus 2a eta 1 eta 2 is equal to 1. Okay. This device is a way to introduce a geometrical object which is called a supersphere. It's a very simple example of a supersphere. It's defined by, well, in particular, the coset of two supergroups, which I'm going to mention in a minute, but geometrically it's simply obtained by summing a certain number of squares of coordinates and saying this is equal to 1, only some of the coordinates are found. Okay, you introduce this supersphere, and it's a technicality that's rather important, that this equation has two solutions in phi depending on the sign. So I'm going to take everywhere the plus sign. This has a meaning which, okay, I'll discuss a little bit, maybe not too much, and pedantically really the mapping is on a Hermite supersphere. So let's solve by this, and then the idea, which I'm going to go through rather quickly, is that we're going to eliminate the quartic term Q2 in this expression at the price of introducing the field phi. So this goes in various stages. The first stage is to observe that if you integrate over phi eta 1 and eta 2 subject to this constraint, then the delta function in the functional integral, when you evaluate the integral and solve the delta function, spits out a Jacobian. A Jacobian which is proportional to phi, therefore to 1 plus a eta 1 eta 2, therefore using Grassmann integration to exponential of a eta 1 eta 2. Therefore, this Jacobian in fact reproduces exactly the Q1 term. So I can get rid of the Q1 term by this first trick, and I'm left with something that is a quadratic form and then a quartic form. Now the trick to get rid of the quartic form is then to introduce a vector u with one bosonic coordinate phi and two fermionic coordinates, eta 1 and eta 2, and the scalar product u over u of j equal to phi of phi phi of j plus a eta 1 eta 2 plus a eta 2 eta 1. Most of you will recognize here the OSP12 invariant product. Get back to this later. And it's therefore elementary algebra to show that if you take the sum over ij of u of I scalar u of j, using this definition, solve for phi of I and phi of j using this equation, replacing there, you get the quadratic terms, and from the product of eta 1, eta 2 of I, eta 1, eta 2 of j, the quartic. Okay? And therefore, the claim is that the functional integral with this action will be exactly equal to the arboreal gas partition. Why I would want to do such a manipulation will become clear in a minute if you're not already seeing what you call its interest. Okay. So therefore, up to a rescaling, I'm now going to get rid of the variable A and put it entirely in the coupling, quote unquote, of the theory. I claim that the arboreal gas partition function is equal to the following discrete integral on the lattice. This metric is product over I of d phi of I, d eta 1 of I, d eta 2 of I, and I have a certain quadratic form, 1 over 2a, sum over I and j of u of I minus u of j. You've all seen this, even pure mathematicians, I'm sure. This is a basic example of a field theory, a slightly interacting field theory, in the sense that u is not a free variable. It is a variable that is defined. I realize I forgot to write this on the transparency, sorry. That's obeying, of course, u of I squared that is equal to 1. All right. So there we go. That's again an exact result. Now, what am I going to do with this result? Of course, what I want to do is move towards field theory and move towards asking about the phase diagram of this system and about the emergence of non-compact degrees of freedom. So I'm therefore going to take a continuum limit of this object, which will be obtained in an extremely naive way, simply by expanding u of I minus u of j as a Taylor series and keeping the most relevant term. And therefore, I'm going to say that in the continuum limit, the partition function of my arboreal gas is the integral over the manifold u square equals to 1, u having one bosonic and two fermionic coordinates. It is, in fact, strictly speaking, the manifold OSP12 over OSP02 of e to the minus s, s being a quadratic action, written that way in terms of u, written like this in terms of the components phi, eta 1, eta 2, and all the difficulty of the problem, therefore, is that we're integrating over a space with the constraint u squared is equal to 1.
So, okay. Slightly nervous, how do you preserve the hemisphere property when it doesn't seem to be encoded into the formalism anymore? Or do you? So can that introduce sectors into the field theory?
Yeah, strictly speaking, the arboreal partition function is equal to this integral over the body of u positive.
Okay.
So then the question will be whether the physics of the full sigma model and the physics of the hemisphere sigma model are the same.
The full one can have sectors.
So yeah, or we could think in terms of sectors, obviously. Yeah. The idea would be that there's a big phase where the symmetry is spontaneously broken, and therefore the field does not deviate much from. And then there'll be another phase, and there'll be a phase transition. Okay. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the autosymplectic symmetry, let me quickly remind you that the symmetry of this action can be seen on infinitesimal transformation of the type delta phi equal delta xi1 eta1 plus delta xi2 eta2, where delta xi1 and delta xi2 are quote-unquote infinitesimal Grassmann variables, and similar transformations for delta eta1, delta eta2. We're having a parameter space of infinitesimal transformation depending upon delta xi1, delta xi2, delta a, delta b, and delta c, which is exactly the group OSP1. Okay? If you don't want to think of the boson and integrate it out, you get the problem of the quartic action, and then the symmetry acts strongly now. Okay. Now, there would be a lot to say about this toy, but I'm not going to dwell into this so much. What I want to do is move on into the physics of the arboreal gas and ask myself what I can learn about this physics from the mapping on the supersphere sigma matter. Okay. Now, the idea is that we're going to think perturbatively for now and deduce features of the phase diagram of the supersphere sigma matter from well-known features of the phase diagram of the ordinary sigma matter. Now we know that for the On over n minus 1 sigma model, the sigma model on an ordinary sphere, the beta function at first order, dg over d log b, where g is the coupling constant in the action, and here for a minute or two I have to use ideas of renormalization group, to first order is proportional to n minus 2. Okay. And therefore it has the following physics. When n is greater than 2, only g positive makes sense anyway, otherwise the functional integral over there would not be defined. And if g is positive, we see that physically g flows to 0 to infinity at large distances, which physicists interpret by saying that symmetry is restored at large distances, since the fact that g is very big means s is almost 0, and therefore big fluctuations are allowed, big fluctuations restore the symmetry, and therefore the continuous symmetry cannot be broken in two dimensions. Give it the name you want, there's so many names, Goldman, Merlin, Wagner, and others, theorem. Okay? It's easy to show perturbatively that the beta function is the same for orthosymplectic groups, for the supersphere, provided you take for n the number of bosons minus the number of fermions, super dimension of the fundamental representation. For the model I'm interested in, therefore, n is equal to minus 1, and therefore, this coefficient, instead of being positive, is negative, which tells me there's a different physics. It tells me that now if g is smaller than 0, I flow to strong coupling and the symmetry is restored, but if g is positive, I flow to weak coupling. Therefore, there's a region around g positive, which means a region around a negative and small, where the symmetry is spontaneously broken. Okay? And it's a message that might amuse some of you, that symmetry can be spontaneously broken in two dimensions if the target space is a supersphere. In fact, it can be broken if the target space is non-compact. It can be broken in all kinds of circumstances, which one does not always think of when I think of this theory. Okay? So the point is, this whole phase of G small and positive is massless and is flowing towards a fixed point, which is the fixed point G equals 0. But G equals 0 is A equals 0, and A equals 0, we argued, was the ordinary spanning trees problem. So in other words, this spanning forest for A positive is massive, it exhibits exponential correlation decay. For G negative, for A negative, sorry, it is massless and behaves at large distances like a single spanning tree. Okay? That's the conclusion from the physics of the model, which I'm not going to dwell on too much because I want to move on. Okay, just to mention a thing or two in particular. So this is just what I said. For A positive, it's massive. For A negative and small enough, it's massless. And usually this kind of argument that we've made is perturbative. It's based on the first non-trivial order of the beta function. We all know that when we go to higher orders, there might be other terms, and there might in particular be a critical point, a point where something special happened, and that's the point I want to move to, and beyond which the theory probably again is messy. Okay. Since we showed that the arboreal gas maps onto the Q-state post model, it's interesting to mention very briefly that if we use known information about the phase diagram of the Q-state post model and use that information to approach the limit Q goes to zero with e to the k minus 1 proportional to Q, the limit in which I said that the post model coincided with the arboreal gas model, we would find the same feature. We would find a massless phase, and we would find a critical line corresponding technically to the antiferromagnetic pulse model where something special happens. Okay? So now what I want to do after this quick and short discussion of the weakly coupled sigma model is move on to the critical point of this arboreal gas. And this will be, to my knowledge, the first kind of non-compact field, the first example of a non-compact field theory popping out of a geometrical problem. It's not the most satisfactory geometrical problem you could think of. More will come later, hopefully, but that's the simplest example. Okay? So when we talk about the critical point, we go back to Lincoln's question. In the broken symmetry phase, the fact that we're on a hemisphere or a full sphere or supersphere doesn't really matter because the field does not fluctuate much. It's clear that when you go to the critical point, you'll have bigger and bigger fluctuations, and you may start worrying about whether the critical point of the hemisphere model is the same as the critical point of the pole model. There will be some non-perturbative effects, and obviously what I'm going to discuss here will be the critical point of the hemisphere model. Now, the claim I'm going to make, which took us, in fact, and Yassine Eklef was also invested in this work, is the claim I'm going to make is that at the critical point, the field theory is non-compact. Okay? So the claim will be the following. The critical value is minus 4 for the square lattice, for the fugacity of the trees A. That's easy to find. And the claim is that at this critical point, the field theory is a dumb non-compact field theory. It is simply a free theory with the same fermions we had in the broken symmetry phase, supplemented by a boson, which this time is simply non-compact. That's the claim. And I'm going to spend a little time justifying it. It's going to be a little bit technical. And ultimately, it's going to use the Bethe-Amsath solution. And I'm sorry for this technicality, but I need to justify this claim a little bit before I move on to other things. So at this value of A on the square lattice, it so turns out that the model is exactly solvable. It has a certain set of Bethe-Amsath equations, which you know come from the quantum interscattering formalism. These equations, I wrote them because they are interesting in their own right. They involve two kinds of roots, alpha and beta. So this is a shorthand notation. We're looking for many roots. It should be an alpha sub j here, obeying a set of complicated equations of the type that a root minus I over a root plus I to the power n, a root of type alpha, is equal to the product over all roots of type beta of alpha minus beta minus 2i over alpha minus beta plus 2i, and similarly for the roots of type beta. This has an interesting algebraic structure, some of you may spot already. I'll mention it next. The energy of the model, the logarithms of the eigenvalues of the transfer matrix, are given by a certain numerical factor, which is there to ensure that the model is isotropic, times the sum of all the roots of 1 over 1 plus alpha squared plus 1 over 1 plus beta squared. Okay. Now, these are technicalities. It's not really worth maybe spending too much time on these equations, except for an interesting fact which will allow me to move on to my other examples of non-compact field theories very soon, which is that these equations have a structure of the type 0 minus 2 minus 2, 0, pretty much, meaning the roots of type alpha do not couple to roots of type alpha, but only to roots of type beta. And if you're familiar with the beta on that, you may recognize that this is typical of the superalgebra OSP 2.2. In fact, it's the next step in this complicated logic. We found out that indeed the beta equations we obtained at the critical point were the same as the beta equations for the OSP 2.2 spin sheet. In other words, morally, the symmetry being OSP 1.2 in the weakly coupled phase is enhanced to OSP 2.2 at the critical point. Okay. So this technicality is maybe not worth mentioning very much, except that it's rather natural to think OSP 2.2 in this problem could play a role when you're thinking of the Potts model or the square lattice, which you remember is related with SU2Q in the fundamental representation. And if you put together two spins one half, well, you get something of size 4, and at Q equals I, it's rather clear that it maps onto OSP 2.2. Anyway, I won't say any more about this. What I want to do now is keep thinking of superspheres, and I'm going to argue next that the critical point of the OSP 1.2 sigma model is in fact related with the OSP 2.2 sigma model, and there will be the non-compactedness popping out very neatly. Okay. So let's think therefore of other superspheres. Let's think now of superspheres of the type OSP N2M over OSP N-1. How long do I have to
so you start from the slide. You have 8 minutes.
8 minutes?
No,
let's
have,
make,
no,
let's
you
make
have
that 15.
Okay. You have 13 minutes, sir. You have 13
okay,
minutes.
Let's make that 16. All right. So we discussed the OSP 1.2 case. Let me briefly now move on to the next case, the OSP 2.2 case. I would like to discuss it in some details. It's quite instructive. The OSP 2.2 will be obtained by taking a vector whose coordinates are phi 1, phi 2, two bosons, and then eta 1, eta 2, subject to the constraint of supersphere constraint, that now phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared minus 2 eta 1, eta 2 is equal to. Okay. Now let me play the same game as before. Let me try to solve the constraint as much as I can in order to get simpler field theory. I mean, field theory with fewer degrees of freedom. Okay. Now, parametrize phi 1 and phi 2 for being this equation. By phi 1 is cos phi, phi 2 is sine phi, times the proper fermionic combination. Okay. This time, I don't have a problem of choosing a sign because the manifold is big enough. I can describe the whole set of solutions with the angle phi. All right. Here, phi is compact. Now, there is a place where we see explicitly this issue of compactedness. The field phi that we're introducing is defined only modulo 2 pi. Therefore, we physicists say the target space is compact. It's a circle. Okay? Or it's an interval with the extremities identified. Now, using this solution, I can put everything back into the action, and I can obtain an action that's a bit complicated. It now involves one boson and the fermion, and then I have the quantic term, and then I have some more terms. Okay. The point is the following, that I can also, of course, rescale. That's a purely technical maneuver to get this new action, with now the coupling G appearing explicitly here and there, and the field compactified in phi, identified with phi plus 2 pi over square root of G. Now, this OSP 2.2 sigma model has its little n, the little n in the beta function. Dg over d log n is n minus 2 g squared. Has its little n up to a factor of pi, equal to 0 this time. 2 minus 2 is 0. So the sign of the beta function is the same as for OSP 1.2, so therefore g positive flows to 0 at large distances, provided it's small. Okay. But if it flows to 0, what kind of theory are we obtaining? We're obtaining a theory where this coupling disappears, so we get a free boson, a fermionic term, and g going to zero means the radius goes to infinity. So the manifold is blowing up, is becoming bigger and bigger, and as g goes to zero, it really goes to infinity. In fact, it goes to infinity in relation with the logarithm of the scale in the randomizer. So that's the way that a non-compact direction appears at this radial point. And maybe I'll be extremely quick about this, but the point is that this conclusion, which we reach somewhat with qualitative arguments, can be put to a very strong test by looking at the Bethe-Ansatz equation, that's work we did with Yassine and Jesper, that is the spectrum of a theory with a pair of symplectic fermions and a boson whose radius is very large, asymptotically should be of the form, and here you recognize the Coulomb gas you're all familiar with, where the standard Coulomb gas with quadratic expressions and finite coefficients, and then a less standard Coulomb gas where the coupling constant, the effective coupling constant, depends on the size of the system and goes to zero eventually as n goes to infinity. So it took us quite a bit of work to investigate numerically and analytically the solutions of the Bethe equations, look for the scaling of the dimensions, and check that this expression was obtained, including the coefficients. So really we have complete control about the coefficients in the divergence of the radius, and therefore a very strong test of the hypothesis. Okay. So that's a non-compact field theory that emerges here, and now I'm going to not give details about the Bethe-Ansatz because it's too late, but move on to the big family of non-compact conformal field theories that are associated with simple geometrical models. And I want to say a bit about this and then raise some questions at the end. Okay? So why should OSP? Yeah.
Because the
logarithmic
correction equals to marginality in the relevant population.
Yes.
So you are not really at the fixed point.
Sorry?
You are not really at the fixed point. You don't really have conformal field theory. You may have logarithmic correction in the world.
I can't hear, sorry.
You are not really at the fixed point.
No, the fixed point is only, the fixed point would be only in the limit of the infinite system. So the infinite system is
up to logarithmic correction everywhere. All correction functions in that.
I'm not saying there are logarithmic corrections.
Because it's marginally irrelevant.
It's not, no, I take that back. It's not marginally irrelevant. I mean, dg goes like g squared. So again, what's the point? Is that
and for correlation function, we have the logarithmic correction. Yeah. If you look at the two-point function, I don't know which operator, there will be a scale, like the power law, times some possible logarithmic some power.
Yeah, I guess.
So you have.
Well, it's not
a conformal field theory. It's like
there is an underlying conformal field theory. There is there is a well-defined fixed point.
The conformal field theory is
the corrections.
Is
no, so then in the underlying conformal field theory, you keep all the logarithmic correction.
No. In an infinite system, the correlation functions of some variables I'm going to introduce will go logarithmically with the distance. It's not a correction, right? They are proportional to the logarithm. Others will have correlations that will be algebraic, the power that varies continuously.
Well, algebraic
It's not the leading term, it's a correction.
For some it's really a correction, some it's actually a living part of the leading.
But we'll see these correlators next, okay? So why are autosymplectic, why is the autosimplicity related with non-compactedness? That's where I would like to moving. So the point is that most of the models we're familiar with, these percolation and polymer problems, even though they often bear names like ON or O2, really typically are based on SU and unitary groups and not orthogonal groups, in my opinion. Why so? Well, it's clear if you think, for instance, of taking the fundamental representation of OSP and asking yourself about the invariant tensors obtained when you make the tensor product of two OSP representations. You have really three invariant tensors corresponding to, and I'm jumping into a graphical notation which I hope is familiar with to people, well, the identity, the contraction of the two representations onto the singlet, and that's all we would have for a SU type model, but for an autosymplectic model, we have another invariant which allows us to cross lines. Therefore, models related with OSP generically will have lines that can cross once. And I'm going to claim it can make a big difference. Now, in more pedantic terms, the existence of this diagram is related with a certain algebra called the Brouwer algebra, which allows one generically, like we know that, for instance, percolation is related with the Temple-Lelib algebra at a value of the parameter equal to 1, so that E squared is equal to E. If we allow loops to cross once, we obtain models related with the Brouwer algebra, defining coverings of the square lattice with loops intersecting things. Now, the claim is that these models are described in the continuum limit by the autosymplectic, a quick coupling, by the autosymplectic sigma models, and in particular, the conformal properties are the conformal properties of the autosymplectic sigma. So the models we obtain are models where we have loops covering the lattice with a fugacity n minus 2n, which has to be smaller or equal to 2, if we want the general results about the phase diagram to apply, and then a certain weight w per intersection. And the claim is that while with W is equal to 0, we're in the universality class of the dense loop model that we all know about, the claim is that the instant we turn on W and allow for intersections, even though the intersections on the lattice occur at most once, and in that sense the model on the lattice is still compact, the continuum limit is different, and the exponents become the ones of the orthosymplectic sigma model on the supersphere. Therefore, critical exponents are obtained by looking at the underlying conformal field theory, which is a theory of n minus 1 on compact bosons and 2n symplectic functions. Therefore, the exponents of the self-intersecting dense loop models, that's something we discussed with Jesper and Nick a couple of years back already, are very different from those of the ordinary dense loop. In particular, the central charge becomes simply the fugacity of the loops minus 1 instead of this complicated expression which we all know. All the k leg exponents are 0. It's very disappointing. Okay, maybe I'll skip this because it's not. So, for instance, this can be checked numerically to some great accuracy. Here are some results of the spectrum of the transfer matrix, which gives rise to the central charge at n equals 0, where we remember that dense loops would have central charge minus 2, which, as soon as W is turned on, moves up to the value minus 1, predicted by the autosymplectic model. All the exponents, like the K-leg exponent, which take these non-trivial values we all know at the dense point, asymptotically approach zero logarithmically for large sizes, and therefore they're trivial, they're not interesting. So in a way I've made a big story about a model which in the end has trivial exponents, even though I'm feeling happy that the continuum limit is not compact. It's a bit disappointing, maybe not so disappointing. It certainly raises the question, I'm almost done, I promise. It raises the question of, well, what do these objects we've introduced have to do with Brownian motion, since after all we're having a non-compact theory, and we argued that in the infrared the theory is just a bunch of non-compact bosons and symplectic film. So we started with Yacine and Jesper looking into more details into the properties of these objects, which I'm going to call trails. So we're having dense objects, like the dense loops, covering the lattice or the surrounding of lattice of the square lattice, and allowed to intersect each other once, at most at a given point, with a certain fugacity W. For these problems, so the question we're raising is, how do these problems compare with Brownian motion? And that's really a very open-ended question. The exponents xk are all zero, we argued, like they would be for Brownian motion. How about the non-intersection exponents? And this is something we've been able to investigate only numerically, but here are some results. You can define non-intersection exponents for these kinds of trajectories as well. Here is an example where I have one of these guys, actually it's a loop, that starts near the origin and then does what it's allowed to do, and is leaving a path connecting the origin to infinity. And we can, more generally, define some sort of non-intersection exponents like it's been done for Brownian motion, with N1 open trails and N2 loop trails, and ask for the value of the exponents. It's well known. I wouldn't venture to say who did it first, that in the Brownian case, the exponents are of the form m squared minus 1 over 12, with m is 2n1 plus 3n2. In particular, the case n2 equals 0 is the usual intersection, non-intersection exponents that you can see in form determined numerically last century. And we have studied these exponents for trails by brute force, because that's all we have, by transfer matrix and by Monte Carlo. Of course, it's much more difficult to do than Brownian motion, because it's pretty much self-avoiding, except that they have to intersect. They can intersect each other at most once. And we find numerically results that are tantalizingly close to the following formula, similar to the one I mentioned for Brownian walks, with a different form from M. In fact, when we found this formula, we didn't know the formula for Brownian motion, so it's sort of pure phenomenology, and it was very nice to see that the formula actually existed for Brownian motion. So you're here having some numerical values. I'm not saying they're absolutely fantastic, but again, it's pretty hard to measure, and they agree reasonably well with the predictions. So my hunch at this stage would be that these autosymplectic curves have properties very close to Brownian motion, and their boundaries have properties very close to boundaries of Brownian motion. How to go from this observation to calculating the exponents within the non-compact field theory? Well, I'm not sure yet. That's part of the investigation. This will be an open-ended talk. But there are many more things to say about non-compact field theories and geometry, and it's all about at this stage. So wait and see. Thanks.